Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Waterfront Church. If you got your Bibles, open to Matthew chapter 5, and then Esther chapter 4. Matthew chapter 5 and Esther chapter 4. Thanks for braving the rain to hang out with us today. I promise you the passage we're going to look at today is going to bring you some hope. This is when everything in our story kind of begins to turn. Matthew chapter 5, verse 14 through 16. Have you ever had to speak during a really big moment? You ever had to speak during a really big moment? Now, for some of you, big moment means lots of people. For some of you, big moment means giving the toast at a wedding. You know what I mean? You ever done that before? Oh my goodness. Whether you're the best man, maid of honor, or just the poor person that they picked to do that. You know what I mean? You got to navigate the waters of keeping the bride happy, the groom happy, and not making the moment about you. You know what I mean? That is a spotlight magnified moment that you got to make happen. There's some of you in this room who work in sales, and that magnified moment is where you've got it circled on the calendar, and you know, big donor meeting, big prospective buyer meeting, and you know you got to be on that day because it's a big moment for you, right? The light shines down on you. There are some of you who are in the congregation right now that get to moderate a debate every now and again. Adam, love it. Adam Ferris over here. Adam got to moderate a debate on C-SPAN. That's high class, dude. High class. In fact, it was really cool seeing the C-SPAN thing at the bottom. I thought, I know that guy. And the eight other people watching this know him too. I mean, it was just really cool, right? Anyway, I'm just kidding. Some of you work for C-SPAN, I was just kidding. Right, anyway, but it was way cool to watch. When you're getting ready for that big magnified moment, there's some of you got to give a speech, give your testimony at church. I mean, I'm telling you, these big magnified moments, especially in our city, I don't care who you are, this is the city of magnification and megaphone, right? Everything that happens here, that says here, has a big old spotlight on it. We've been walking through the verse in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. And here's what Jesus says. He says, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father who is in heaven." Stop right there for just a minute. Jesus gives us great advice as believers for any circumstance. He says, remember, you are the light in the darkness. You are the light of the world. You're meant to be put on that stand to give light to everyone in the house. But what I love about this passage for DC, for those of us in this room, I'm telling you, there are moments where God is going to place you on a stand that is a little bit bigger and the light is just a little bit brighter because of your circumstances. We're going to call these today magnified moments. There are some of you in this room that have a magnified moment, a big moment circled on the calendar. Sometimes it's a big stage. Sometimes it's a big sale. Sometimes it's because you've got an illness. And you've got that big date on the calendar circled because you're going to have to navigate some tests that come in from a doctor. And here's the picture. You as a believer in Jesus Christ have made the decision that you not only want to stand firm for your family, but you want to be a good witness for Jesus Christ when you navigate that magnified moment of the unthinkable. Sometimes it's when a reporter shoves a microphone in your face. I love getting to watch this guy, Case Keenum. Y'all watch Case Keenum, quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings? He's been extra special to us. I'm not particularly a Vikings fan. Don't boo or hiss, okay? But I'm not particularly a Vikings fan. I didn't grow up cheering for the Vikings. But Case's dad was a special family friend. In fact, Case's dad is the director of Fellowship of Christian Athletes for the Abilene, Texas area. And Case's dad actually spoke at my father's funeral. So we've been cheering for Case, third string quarterback who gets to take the team to the playoffs. I mean, it really was special to watch. Can I tell you what happened? They're playing the divisional game to play for the NFC Championship game and to play, see who gets to go to the NFC Championship game. And do you remember the play? Case Keenum drops back to pass, last play of the game, chunks the ball up to a guy named Stephon Diggs. Diggs catches the ball and runs into the end zone with no time left on the clock. I mean, it was the miraculous play of miraculous plays. Whole stadium's going crazy. One of the greatest moments in Vikings football history. Can I tell you what's about to happen? A magnified moment for Case. The magnified moment was not when he threw the touchdown pass. The magnified moment is when the reporter's going to stick the microphone in his face afterwards and say, "How do you feel, dude? You just had this great moment. How do you feel?" Now, just for the record, Case is a disciple. Not just a disciple, he's a disciple maker. He loves the Lord with great passion, great fervor. I can tell you that honestly, knowing his family. Case, go back and watch it on YouTube. The reporter shoves the microphone in his face after this grand moment, confetti falling, all that stuff. And with the microphone in his face, the reporter goes, "Case, this incredible moment for Vikings, how do you feel?" And the microphone's in his face, and Case doesn't disappoint. In his magnified moment, Case says, "It's the third best moment of my life. Number one is when I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. Number two is the day I married my wife. And number three has to be this moment right here. You know what he did in his magnified moment? He just said to millions of people that Jesus Christ and his decision to follow him was the most important thing. Said the name Jesus so that millions of people could hear it. The second thing he said was, my relationship with my wife is more important than football. What a beautiful testimony in two little sentences that Case Keenum was able to throw out in that magnified moment. Why was he able to do that? Scripture says, because what's in a man comes out of a man. When he gets squeezed in the magnified moment, what's in you comes out of you. That's the picture with these heavy moments. Now, just for the record, sometimes it's the microphone, sometimes it's the sales meeting, and sometimes, you parents in this room, it's when a kid makes a mistake. You ever had to parent somebody who made a mistake? It's the worst. It's the worst, right? Because you love the kids so much. Because you love them so much. And I'm telling you, even the harshest parent hates that moment. Because I'm telling you, all you can see is your little child that you've raised since birth. And so all you want to do is wrap your arms around it when they make a mistake. But the moment is magnified. There's sometimes when a kid makes a mistake specifically for the first time that you've got to turn it into that moment in hopes that they won't make that mistake again. Our sweet daughter Lulu, Lulu's seven. Lulu is the apple of my eye. Most of y'all know that already. 7 years old. She's teeny tiny. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. Sweet Lulu, 7 years old. Curly blonde hair. She's born a zero percentile. She's tiny. I'm telling you, Lulu is just, Lulu's very special. Love, we love all of our kids equally, but I'm telling you, each one is special for a different reason. Lulu's so small, you just root for her. She's also like me. All you have to do is say one negative word to her and she melts like butter. I mean, it's just who she is, right? So sweet Lulu, we teach our kids not to steal. It's one of the things we always teach people. It's always good. Number one, it's biblical. It's a sin. Number two, you can go to jail, right? In case it's a bad thing. Sweet Lulu. Sweet Lulu's the kid that brings a whole bunch of toys everywhere she goes, and then her friends will take the toys, and she didn't care. You know, that's just who she is. She didn't care. But we were telling her, you know, you can let other people do that, but you cannot take something without asking. That's stealing. That's theft. And so we tell her, you can't do those things. And of course, she's been taught that since she was younger. Well, a week and a half ago, Lulu comes home, and she has this little beanie baby. It's not really a beanie baby. It's, I don't know what they are. They're like these rainbow animals with huge eyes. I don't know what they're called, but she's got this little rainbow character with huge eyes. Cost about $3 each. She comes in with one that's a tiger that we have not ever seen before. All right. So we realize that something's up. My wife, and she'll refute this in the second service or the third service. My wife comes up, sees that Lulu has that, does the research and realizes that she has taken that from one of her friends at school, but hadn't asked for it. It's at that point that my wife looks at her and says, when your father gets home, he's going to have a talk with you. Urgh, I wish I'd been the one to say that instead, right? She passed the buck. I've then got to have a magnified moment. I know that it's just a $3 toy that probably she just took without asking, and it might even be in her brain being considered borrowing, but we want her to know you don't take something without asking or without paying for it. So guess what I do? As I talk with Ott, I'm about to walk into the bedroom to talk to her, and I get emotional. I mean, I'm telling you, she's my daughter, and I'm a crier, so I get these tears in my eyes, and I'm like, oh, no, she's going to be sad. Oh, no, she's going to be upset. My daughter, you know, this sweet apple in my eyes, she's going to be upset. And so then I wipe the tears from my eyes, put on the angry dad face, you know what I mean? I mean, I'm telling you, that really, that Randall's brow, you know, we narrow it like this, and I mean, just, so I put on my angry face, and then I open the door. Well, Lulu, seeing the angry face that she doesn't see very often, melts immediately. And guess what she does? She holds out her arms. She goes, Daddy, I'm sorry. Daddy, I'm sorry. I hadn't even said anything to her yet. Guess what I've got to do? Because I love her. Because again, it's the magnified moment. I have to hold her at arm's length. Oh, that was awful. I hold her at arm's length. I set her down next to the bed. And I said, we need to have a talk. I said, your mother tells me that you stole something. She goes, it was my friend's and she takes my stuff all the time. And I said, I don't care what she does. You stole something. She begins to weep and she goes, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'll never do it again. I looked at her and I said, I'm really glad to hear you say that. There's a couple of things you still need to do. I said, first of all, you sinned against the Lord. believer in Jesus Christ. She claimed belief in Christ 2 years ago, was baptized last year. And I told her, I said, first thing you need to do is tell God that you're sorry for what you've done. She starts to cry. I said, I know it's hard, but you got to do it. The moment's magnified. We're trying to set the tone here so that this doesn't happen again on a bigger level. As we sit down, she prays, tells the Lord she's sorry in the sweetest little prayer imaginable. And then after it's done, I said, and now we got to talk to your friend. You got to tell your friend that you're sorry because you took it without asking. She starts to cry again. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I said, then maybe you should think about not doing this again. It was awful. It was awful. Just for the record, any of you ever had a moment like that with your parents? They're not over there going, how can I cause them problems? They're sitting there in agony. I'm just telling you. I'm sitting there in agony. And then finally, after we talk to the friend, after we get it set, she looks up at me and I wrap my arms around her and tell her, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. Now let's not do this again. Listen, magnified moments come in different shapes and sizes. But you know when the light is shining down, when God calls you to put the lamp on a big stand that's going to have lasting implications, not just for right now, but also for later as well. Here's the big question. How do you share Christ in those big moments? If you're taking notes, a little tweetable quote for you here. In the presence of the light, the truth becomes undeniable, especially when God magnifies that light. Let me say that again. In the presence of the light, the truth becomes undeniable, especially when God magnifies that light. Jesus says, put the lamp on a stand that they may see your good deeds and then glorify your Father who is in heaven. My hope with Lulu is that she wouldn't just look back on that moment and remember her father, but remember that her father pointed her to the Lord and showed her how to gain forgiveness in the midst of that circumstance, whether it be on a small level or on a big level. All sin falls short of God's glory. There are some of you in this room who have that big magnified moment circled on the calendar that you're working towards and you're preparing for. If that's you, today is your message, all right? Great little breakdown from the life of Esther on how to get ready for that big magnified moment. And there are some of you in this room, the date may not be on the calendar, but I promise you it's coming. I promise you, in this city, again, with the magnification and the megaphone that we've got here, there will come a moment sooner than later where you also have to put the lamp on a stand and shine for Christ on a big, big stage. If you're taking notes, here's our big million-dollar question today. How do we prepare for a magnified moment? How do we prepare for that big magnified moment where the Lord calls us to put the lamp on a stand where something is going to be large and lasting? Let's look at Esther chapter 4. Flip over to Esther chapter 4. And we're going to start in verse 9. Esther chapter 4, and we're going to start in verse 9. For those of you who've been a part of our Esther study, you can go back and listen to the podcast or watch on Facebook. Facebook Live has all these different sermons and studies that we've been going through, so you can watch that way. Just know, the little flyby is Esther takes place 500 years before the birth of Jesus, and this is basically the enemy's last-ditch effort to try to enact the genocide so that the Jewish people will be eradicated and the devil can stop the coming of Christ. Just so you know, our God is so much bigger than that. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but that's the plan here. The idea is that if there can be a genocide to eliminate the Jewish people from the world, that maybe that can slow or halt the coming of Jesus Christ. So as we go through this passage, there's a guy named Xerxes. He's the Persian king. Xerxes is married to a woman named Esther, but she's a part of this concubine. She's a part of this harem. She is the head queen. She's the queen, but she's one of many in the king's harem. And she is a Jew. Her cousin is a guy named Mordecai. Mordecai is a city official. He also is Jewish. And then the wicked man in this passage, the villain, is a dude named Haman. Haman is working as the king's right-hand man. Haman is deeply racist, an awful, awful individual. And Haman gets the idea that he is going to try to perform a mass genocide on the Jewish people with the king's approval. It's been put into policy. And the goal is to enact it all on one day in the following year. It's done on one day so that they can celebrate it year after year as a holiday. Now, that is the definition of wickedness. Not only to eradicate the Jewish people and perform this genocide, but to do it all on one day as a way to kind of memorialize it. This dude Haman is bad news. And so here's what happens. Mordecai goes to Esther and says through this through Hathach, this eunuch that's kind of carrying the messages back and forth to the palace, Mordecai says to Esther, you got to talk to the king. You're the queen. You got to talk to the king and beg for the lives of the Jewish people. But Esther does like anyone does when that light shining moment, that magnified moment comes up. Esther gets a little insecure. Let's look at what happens in Esther chapter 4, verse 9 through 11. It says, so Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people in the royal provinces know that for any man or woman to approach the king in the inner courts without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception for this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and to spare his life. But 30 days have passed. I know 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Stop right there for just a minute. It doesn't matter what level you're on in this city. When God has called you to stand for him, the first wave of emotion that you feel is a little bit of insecurity and fear. The idea, because this city is so intricate, you already have to walk a razor's edge when it comes to your faith and the job that you're in. And I'm telling you, what happens is just like with Esther. Esther's serving in a policy position. She's serving as the queen. And she looks at Mordecai and goes, you don't know what you're asking. I can't just go into the king. She said, a law has been made that if anyone shows up unannounced in the king's court, that then the king can have them executed right there on the spot. It doesn't matter if you're the queen. She says, then he has the opportunity to extend the gold scepter to me. Basically, I'll hear you out in this moment if he doesn't decide to kill her. And then she says, but one other problem. It's been 30 days since I've seen him. She not only speaks to policy insecurity, but remember, she's a part of the harem. Harem's that Hebrew word for enclosure. It's the same word that's used for prison or for cage. She comes in and she goes, it's been 30 days since I've seen him. What if I go in and he's with another woman? What if I go in and he has me executed just because he feels shame because he's with somebody else? When God calls you for those magnified moments, insecurity is normal. But the disciple fights through it. The disciple knows that God's will is so much bigger and that you were created, just like we're going to read about in a moment, for such a time as this. Let's look at what happens next. Esther's about to get a Super Bowl halftime worthy pep talk right here. You ready? Esther chapter 4, verses 12 through 14. Here's what she says. Here's what Mordecai says to her. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you're in the king's house, that you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, look at this, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. Underline, will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows, but that you have come to this royal position for such a time as this. Stop right there for just a minute. If you're taking notes, how do we prepare for the magnified moments? Number one is through proper perspective. Number one is through proper perspective. When you read Esther and do a study on Esther, most of the time the focus is on the last part of those verses that we just read. That God's created you for such a time as this. The power in the passage actually comes from the first part of the verse. It's both together. It's not one or the other. It's both and. It says, for such a time as this you've been created. But if you don't do it, God is not limited to your ethics and to your work. He says, if you don't do it, then God's going to raise up the deliverance from another place. What a powerful picture that God is not limited to our effort and to our work. In order for us to be prepared for that magnified moment, we must walk the fine line of true humility. We must truly understand that God is so big he can do anything, and that God, in the same time, desires to use us to bring about his glory. If you're taking notes and you don't get anything else from today, take this quote. You ready? God desires to use you, but he is not limited to you. Let me say that one more time. God desires to use you, but he is not limited to you. Insecurity manifests itself on both ends. Sometimes insecurity manifests itself in feeling like if God doesn't have you, then it doesn't work. That's that over egocentric attitude, right? Me coming from Texas, I get it, all right? I get it. Sometimes you can feel like, God's got to have me. I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps and I can live my life whatever way I want to, because the truth is God's got to have me. Just for the record, a whole bunch of great movies are based off of that principle. That's a really fun character to watch in a movie. All you have to do is look at one of the finest pieces of American cinema. Of course, I'm speaking of Bruce Willis's Armageddon, all right? Fantastic movie, right? What's the seal in Armageddon? You remember? Bruce Willis is the deep core driller. Find out that there's an asteroid hurtling towards the Earth, right? And as the asteroid's hurtling towards the Earth, what happens in the movie Armageddon? Bruce Willis gets to build a team, two teams of deep core drillers to drill a hole to the center of the asteroid, blow it in two so that then it won't hit the Earth. You remember the scene? Ben Affleck's been dating his daughter, but he's also been his right-hand guy on the oil rig. Remember, he goes off, and the whole time he's like, ah, I don't want to use Ben Affleck. I don't want to use Ben Affleck. But he goes and he meets with him, and he says, Ben Affleck, look, no, you've been dating my daughter. There's not a job on the planet I would work with you on. However, you're the best option I've got. Some of us view God like Bruce Willis. That God looks at us and goes, ah, I would really love to do this any other way, but you're the best option I've got. I've got to have you. Every buddy cop movie is built on this same principle. Okay, I mean, it's the idea is like that God is the police commissioner, okay, that the station manager is Jesus and we're the rogue cop, you know what I mean? And what happens? Jesus hauls us in and goes, look, I'm tired of defending your harebrained antics to the commissioner, but darn it if you're not the best cop on the force, right? It's not that way. God didn't have to have you. Mordecai says it. He says, if you don't do this, he says, relief will rise up from somewhere else. Ain't no buddy cop story. The other side has no movie examples because it's the worst movie ever. The other example is where you're not too haughty for it. The other example is where you sit and you just go, oh, Lord, you're big, you're strong, you're powerful. I realize I could do something, but you don't need me. Lord, you don't need me. Lord, use someone else to bring about your great glory. Roll credits. Na, na, na. Nobody watches that movie. You know why? Because that person's a loser. That's why. I'm being honest. Nobody watches that movie because they did nothing. They didn't even try. Here's the picture. It's not either or. It's both and. God is so big and so powerful, he does not have to have you, and yet he's created you for such a time as this. He desires to use you to bring about his glory. What a beautiful picture of the greatness of God, big enough to do it on his own, and yet desires to use you for such a time as this. It's not buddy cop. It's not Armageddon. It's not wimp on a couch. The example of eternity here is actually a coach for Friday night football game. Back in the day, every athlete who's played on varsity football before remembers the moment when you get called into the game. It's frightening. We play our very first game, Lubbock Monterey High School. My first game ever was against a school called Abilene Cooper. I never forget, Cooper went to the quarterfinals that year. They were really, really good. Big, big kids too. That year, I think their line averaged 280 pounds in high school. Huge line. That was years ago. They're even bigger now. 280 pounds. We were so nervous going into the game. And guys, just being honest with you, I got put on varsity as a junior, but I wanted that letter jacket. That was really the thing I wanted more than anything else. Get the letter jacket. I'm on the sidelines before that first game, standing on the sidelines waiting for a chance to go in. I've been practicing my whole life, getting ready for this moment. And then all of a sudden, the unthinkable happens. Starting weak side linebacker gets winded, goes down for what will end up being a couple plays. When the linebacker goes down, Coach Corey Barnes is on the sidelines. He was the defensive end linebacker's coach. Coach Corey Barnes starts looking around, sees me, and goes, Randles, get in there. My first thought was, no. For such a time as this. Can I tell you why I went in? Because the coach asked. And you know what's interesting? He'd been preparing me for years for that moment. I run in, they call the play, I get into my position stance, and I'm thinking the whole time, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And here's what happens. As soon as they call hut on the other side of the ball, muscle memory takes over. I'd been training on what to do for half a decade in that particular defense. All of a sudden, I turn, make the run through. Man, I didn't make a tackle, but they sure didn't score on that play, which was awesome, all right? Two plays pass, they don't score, and then I trot to the sidelines. Can I tell you that that's what a picture of this is? The idea that you sit there and I don't go, Coach, I'll go in. You got to have me. My chance here. Or I sit there on the sideline and go, no, no, get somebody else to go. Pick somebody else, anybody but me. No, it's the same. It's both and. God is so big, he can do it another way. And yet for such a time as this, when the coach calls your name, you're ready to go. That's the picture. God is big enough to do it on his own, but he desires to use you. David outlines this principle. Save your spot in Esther. Look at Psalm chapter 8, just a few pages to the right. Psalm chapter 8, verses 3 through 6. David's going to outline this exact same attitude. Here's what David says. David says, look, when I consider your heavens, when I consider the works of your fingers, O God, the moon and the stars, which you set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings, and you crowned him, underline crowned him, with glory and honor. You made him ruler, underline ruler, over the works of your hands, and put everything under his feet. Stop right there for just a minute. Here's what David says. He carries the same balance in this passage. He goes, God, you are so big and so powerful. Your fingers created the universe. Your fingers set the stars in motion. You breathed and the moon existed. The universe is completely under your control. And yet, who am I that you are mindful of me? God, you not only have set me up to be a part of your creation, but you've uplifted me, crowned me as a prince or princess in your kingdom. God, you've set me up as a ruler to make decisions for you, to influence for your world. Look at what he carries. Perfect humility, proper perspective that God is big and can do it anyway, and yet he desires to use you. There are so many, especially in this city, that can fall on both sides of this. Proper perspective is what is required of God's servant. Amen. Proper perspective, real humility, not fake self-deprecating, not over haughty, God's got to have me. But where you understand God is big, God is powerful, God is strong, and yet he desires to use me for his glory. It begs the question, do you know how big God is and how valuable you are? Do you know how big God is and how valuable you are? It's not either or. It must be both and for true humility. When we do that, God can do some really cool stuff. Let's keep moving. Flip back over to Esther chapter 4, and let's read verses 15 and 16. I love Esther. She doesn't even say yes to Mordecai. She just gets to work. Oh, what a powerful woman of God here. You ready for this? Verse 15. Mordecai does the pep talk. Esther sends back. Then Esther sent a reply to Mordecai. Go. I love that. Man, she kicks into action. Go. She started barking orders. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Underline and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days or nights, and I and my maids will do as you do. Look at this. When this is done, underline when this is done, then I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Stop right there for just a minute. A lot of times we focus when we study this passage on if I perish, I perish. The power comes right before that. Here's what Esther says. Once she gains proper perspective that God's big and he desires to use her. Once she gains true humility, her first response after that is, let's start praying. Let's start praying. Let's start fasting. And she says, after I've gotten my heart and mind right, then I will go to the king and make this request. This is power if you're listening to it right here. Guess what she says? She says, I'm going to fast and pray, and I need you to get the whole city of Susa. I need you to get all the Jewish people that are in and around this circumstance to fast and pray for me in this circumstance as well. Don't you know this? Prayer is the way that we get our heart right before God. Fasting is the way that we get our mind right before God. And when that happens, the veil is lifted and you're able to see the hand and the movement of God in the world around us. Here's the picture. So many times we have, instead of prayer, worry that fills our schedule. We worry about things, but we don't actually pray for them. She says, I got to get my heart and mind right so that I can see what God's up to around me. Sometimes when you have a need, you pray for God to come like a lightning bolt. And you sit there and you go, Lord, I need this right here, right now. And we open our arms to wait. And instead of looking for God's work around us, we're watching for the lightning bolt. God rarely works in a lightning bolt. Most of the time, what we do is that our heart and minds get right. You are able then to open your eyes through prayer and go, God, I believe you're coming to help me. Lord, please, please set my mind right so that I can see the works of your hands all around me. God's not working in the lightning bolt. His spirit is constantly working around us all the time. When we fast and pray, we can see it. You know what fasting is? There's a biblical description of how to do this with food, but the basic principle of fasting is that you take a part of your daily schedule, something that you feel like you've needed for survival, And that time you give to God instead. It's the reason that we usually fast with food or with drink. These are things that you need for your survival. And yet what you do for a time, not forever, but for a time, is you say, God, I'm trusting you instead of the food. I'm trusting you instead of the drink. I'm replacing that, and I'm taking that time that I normally would do to sustain my body, and instead I'm giving it to you in prayer. Can I tell you one of the ways that I fast? Fasting with food is clearly not one of my deals, all right? Do it from time to time. But the big way that I tend to fast has to do with my cell phone. If I'm going through a big issue, big struggle, it doesn't matter if you're driving 30 miles, 3 miles, or three blocks. It's going to take you a long way to drive in this city. You know what I mean? Traffic's awful. Whenever I've got a big decision to make, or the Lord is calling for me to get my mind right, first thing I typically do in the car is turn on the radio, or I'll turn on the Bluetooth and I'll talk on the cell phone. Guess what I start doing when I fast? Turn off the radio, turn off the cell phone. The round trip for Lulu's school is about 1 hour and 10 minutes from the house over and then back into the city. That's 1 hour and 10 minutes of prayer time immediately that I can carve out of my daily schedule to spend just me and God in the car. Prayer is to get your heart right. Fasting is to get your mind right, to remind you that you need the Lord for the air that you breathe, that you need the Lord for your very survival. And then all of a sudden, with that mindset in full view, you can see the Spirit working all around you. And it gives you great encouragement for whatever your magnified moment is. Simple story. I've told you some of this. Some of you have gotten to hear this before, but it bears repeating. It was such a heavy moment for us in the beginning. We were trying to recruit money to start Waterfront Church. We're just a matter of months before moving here, and all we had in the account was $10,000. That was it. And we had to beg for that. The overarching goal for 5 years at Waterfront in the beginning, the amount we were trying to raise was $1.3 million. We got $10,000 in the account. Can I tell you God was good? It actually would take twice that. God was good to let me think it was only going to be $1.3 million. I'm about to preach an event called Super Summer, Texas Leadership Camp. For Christian students. And they did a service of consecration where you fasted and prayed to get ready for the kids that were going to come to the conference. And I'll never forget, I'm sitting at the conference and the speaker says, it's time to get your mind right. It's time to get your heart right as we get prepared for what's going to happen with the students. I'm a preacher. And guess what I'm doing there? I'm worrying. I'm not praying. I'm sitting there going, $1.3 million, $1.3 million, $1.3 million. Lord, how's it going to happen? Lord, where's the lightning bolt? Where's it going to happen? Where is this money going to come from? Because if it doesn't, we can't move. And we've told everybody that we're moving. I have no job now, Lord. I got to have this money. Lord, when's it going to come? When's the money going to show up? $1.3 million. And all of a sudden, I have a moment of clarity when I actually started praying. I called out to God. And I said, Lord, I need some reaffirmation. I need some help. I need you to remind me that this is going to work, that you're going to uphold us with your righteous right hand. Now listen, it's sinful to test the Spirit of God, but there are some of you that God's going to call to such big things. To ask God for reaffirmation is different than testing. Testing is when you go, I'm not doing it if you don't prove it. Reaffirmation is where you go, God, I'm walking. I just need you to open my eyes. God, just show me that this work is taking place. This rarely happens for me, but 2 minutes after I pray that, all of a sudden, a youth minister from West Texas comes up, puts his hand on my shoulder, and he goes, bro, I don't know what this means, but he said, the Spirit of God told me to tell you the money's going to come. Exact words, the money's going to come. I start to cry because I'm a crier. He goes, what does that mean? I said, man, $1.3 million. We've been praying for this. All we have is $10,000 in the account. I go, I really needed to hear that. He walks off. A 6'10" youth minister from Beaumont, Texas comes up right after him. Can't miss him. 6'10", puts his hand on my shoulder and he goes, bro, I don't know what this means, but the Lord said to tell you exact words, the money's gonna come. I start to sob at that point. I can't even get words out. This guy's also a golf coach. He looks at me, he goes, bro, what's wrong? And I'm like, I'll tell you later. I'll tell you later. Just for the record, God gives you affirmation like that. You better stinking do whatever it is that you were called to do, all right? It was just the nudge that we needed. That should show you just how desperate the situation was. He sent affirmation, and then all of a sudden, my eyes were open. I could see the hand of God at work around me. And instead of looking at it going, man, we got to raise $1.3 million. It was, how's the Lord going to provide for this? How's the Lord going to provide for that? Lord, our eyes are open. We're ready for your blessing to drop in. It's a change in mindset, proper perspective, and fasting and praying gets your heart and mind ready so that then you say, okay, God, I am waiting with anticipation that my eyes might see the great miracle you bestow upon us. If you're taking notes, a little tweetable quote here. You ready? Our complete dependence on God and our heightened expectance of his involvement paves the way for a miracle that we get to see with our own eyes. Let me say that again. Our complete dependence on God and our heightened expectance of his involvement paves the way for a miracle that we get to see with our own eyes. The way God gets credit, miracles are happening all around us all the time. Why is it in modern culture we miss so many of them? It's because we stop fasting and praying. It's because our minds are not right to see the hand of God at moving all around us. That's the picture here. Fasting and praying get your mind and heart right so that you are ready for that magnified moment, to the point that Esther says, until I fasted and prayed, I'm not taking a step in front of the king. It begs the question, is it time you started praying? Is it time you started praying? Many of you, just like me, you are replacing worry with prayer. That's it. You're already spending time processing it and you don't even realize it. The problem with worry is it's like rocks in a blender. Nothing's working. It's rocks in a blender. All it's doing is hurting you in the process. Take the rocks out and let God put good things in. That change in perspective could make all the difference for you. One last verse and we'll call it a day today. You ready? Look at Esther chapter 4, verse 17. Simple verse, but very powerful. It says here at the end, so Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. Underline carried out all of Esther's instructions. If you're taking notes, how do we prepare for that magnified moment? Number one, we got to gain proper perspective, true humility. God is big, but we are valuable. Second, we've got to fast and pray. Get your heart and mind right for what God's about to do. And last but not least, number three, we need dependable partners. We need dependable partners. There's some of you in this room, and you are so stinking smart. Not just smart, you are also so stinking capable. I think this might be top to bottom the most capable city on planet Earth. You guys are so smart. You guys are so capable. And here's the deal. A lot of times you walk into a situation like this where God's called you to carry this massive task, and you sit there and you go, all right, Lord, I'm trusting you, and I'm going to carry this all the way to the finish line. And then other people watch us carry the burden, and they show up and they go, hey, can I help you? And you go, no, can't help me. This is just between me and God. I've got to do this all by myself. Don't you know what Esther did? And I'm as guilty of this as anybody. Esther looks and she says, get the city praying for me. She says, get the people organized because this is bigger than just me. Not to mention, when God shows up, we want the city to know that I didn't do this, but God did this. God's the one who performed the miracle. So guess what? It's Frodo in Lord of the Rings, right? Remember Frodo and Sam in Lord of the Rings? What does Sam say? I can't carry the burden for you, but I can carry you. That's the idea of what the church has to do for one another. We can't carry the burden of cancer for you. We can't carry the burden of your work situation for you. We can't even carry the weight of your relationship situation or how to raise your kids. But guess what we can do? We can pray for each other. We can have each other's back. The idea is, look, I can't fight forward for you, but nothing's getting behind you. Nothing's coming at your back while you fight forward. Can't we do that for one another? It's the only way. It's the only way that it'll work. When those big magnified moments happen, we as a church have to rise up for one another and say, I can't carry it for you, but I can certainly have your back. If you're taking notes, last tweetable quote today. You cannot move forward if you keep looking back. You cannot move forward if you keep looking back. We're about to go through a little time of invitation. Don't move stuff yet. I'm going to ask this at the end. If there are some of you here today who need someone to have your back in prayer, and I know that this is a city where we don't like to step out and ask for help. I promise you, Esther needed help. She needed someone to have her back. So here's what we're going to do. When we stand in just a minute, right over here on the side, there are going to be some people who want to pray for you today. There are going to be some people who want to bear that burden with you in love. And here's what I need you to do. Have courage to step out and to ask for help. No Lone Rangers here. If you withhold, then the Lord doesn't get the credit for the miracle with the larger group. You got to do your best to ask for help. If we do that, some powerful things are going to happen. I love you guys. I missed you last week, all right? We're not special because we hear the message. We're special because we take it and let the Lord change us. Let's bow our heads for prayer.